My name is Lori Gooding. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. My recovery date is July 1st, 2001, and my home group is the Start Fresh group. We meet Mondays at 5:30 at a place called the Western Club in Oklahoma City. So if y'all are ever in need of an Al-Anon meeting on Mondays at 5:30 and you just happen to be in Oklahoma City, please come see us. I want to thank the committee for asking me and my husband to be here, and thank you, Julia. She's been great. She's kept in contact with me, made sure that I got everything that I could possibly need or want, and I appreciate being asked. I, as most people know by this time, I hate doing this. This is not my favorite thing to do, but I'm really grateful to be able to give back to the program who's given me everything. So I want to thank the committee and thank you guys for having me here. I also want to thank the tapers. I sometimes forget to do that, and you know, I had recordings and CDs and tapes, actual tapes, way before, in the car all the time when I first got here. And I listened to those all the time. And it's kind of like having a meeting with you 24/7, and I really appreciate that. So I want to thank the tapers for recording this. Okay, let's get on with this. Oh, God. I understand there's a football game today. I get that. You know, I'm from Oklahoma. We're a football state. I'm probably not from the team that y'all think of in Oklahoma, but that's okay. And, but yeah, so I noticed that. Yeah, we love football in Oklahoma. We're not brazen enough to put it on the schedule, but we love it. Outside issue where we're from, but apparently not in Georgia. I also noticed, I want to know who the genius was that scheduled it at the Al-Anon workshop at the same time. Who came up with that, I'd like to know. I've already asked Jim about it. He said, we had a group conscience about every decision that was made. So he's taking no responsibility. So I'm telling you about that. That's okay. Apparently Al-Anons are a little bit more spiritual than y'all, but that's all right. We'll pray for y'all in our workshop. All right, I'm just going to get on with this. I was born, and when I was born, I had two older sisters and an older brother waiting on me. My eldest sister is 11 years older than me, and she has drank or done some sort of substance since I can remember, and and she's not an alcoholic. She doesn't claim to be an alcoholic. I don't think she is an alcoholic. I can tell you she gives a good impression of one. I got a sister who is 10 years older than me, and about 8 years ago, she came into the rooms of AA. I am shaking. I am not kidding. My knees are shaking. And she came into the rooms about 8 years ago, and about 2 years ago, she called me, and I answered the phone, and she was crying. And I answered the phone, and I go, hey, and she's like, and I go, what is wrong with you? And she goes, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And I go, why are you crying? And she said, because I really want to be. And I said, well, what happened? And she said, I feel like a fake and a fraud in these rooms. And she said, I've been going to these meetings, and I feel like a fake and a fraud. And I've gone through the steps again with my sponsor. We've gone through the book again. And she says she can't tell me if I'm an alcoholic or not, but she says I'm not an alcoholic. And I said, well, why did you come to AA in the first place? And she said, well, if I'm being honest, I thought my husband would follow me into the rooms. And I said, welcome to Al-Anon. And she's not. She's not an alcoholic. She's just not. She really doesn't want to be, though. She loves you. And then I got a brother. He's 6 years older than me, and he is an alcoholic. He will tell you he's an alcoholic. He is dying of this disease as we speak. He's 6 years older than me. He looks like he's about 80. He's about 6'5". He probably weighs 140 pounds. He's on a dialysis machine 3 times a week. He's got Hep C, and he can't stop drinking. About a year ago, he called me and said that, or a couple years ago, he called me and said that he thought that he needed help stopping drinking. And I gave his number to my husband, who gave it to some guys, and they went out and called on him, and they took him to detox. And after detox, he was just fine. And you can tell how that's going. And you know what? I love my brother, and I love him for who he is and what he is. And the people in Al-Anon taught me to do that, and I didn't know how to do that before because I was very judgmental of him, and I was very critical of him. And now I love him for who he is and what he is, and I'm not trying to change him or make him somebody or something that he's not. And I didn't get that anywhere else but here. And then there's me. I'm the baby, and I've never drank or done a drug in my whole entire life. I know. Just let that sink in. Why wait? And the reason why I never did that is not because of some pure virtue or anything. It's because I had seen what happened to my brothers and sisters when they drank and they got in trouble. And I just didn't want to be like them. And I didn't have the words for it. I didn't have the thought of it. I just knew that I thought that if I didn't drink or drug, I wouldn't be like them and I would not be affected. Obviously, God has other plans. Here I am. But that's what I thought. And I thought I could control stuff way, way, way long ago. I've been trying to control things my whole entire life. My whole entire life. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. My parents are not alcoholics. My dad is the hardest working man I've ever met in my life. We lived on a 10-acre farm in a place called Choctaw, Oklahoma. It was a really small town. We had beef cattle and milk cattle, and we had a huge garden, and we had chickens and the whole thing, and I loved living there. And my daddy started the Trinity Bible Baptist Church in Choctaw, Oklahoma. He was not a minister, but he was a deacon, and he was a song leader for the church. And my mama was a stay-at-home mom and the Sunday school teacher. And I loved everything about my life. I had everybody in that little town knew us, and I knew everybody in that little town. And I had a great life. I loved it. And then I turned 7, and I turned 7, and my mama and my daddy divorced, and they kicked my daddy out of that church that they started, and my life turned upside down. And it wasn't really the divorce that got me. What happened was my mama moved me to a suburb of Oklahoma City called Moore, Oklahoma. If there's anybody from Moore or knows people from Moore, I am sorry, but I hated Moore. It made my fist step. Anyway. And I hated Moore, Oklahoma, and you know, and it was just because it was something so totally different from anything that I'd been around. And you know, my nearest neighbor was a mile and a half down the road, and I could like reach out and touch the house next door, and that was just so foreign to me. And kids were mean to me for the first time. I'd never been teased before or made fun of other than my brother, and kids were mean to me for the first time. And the reason why they were mean to me is I was the ugliest kid in school. I'll give you an idea of what I look like. If you would like pictures, my husband has some on his phone. He will be glad to show them to you. By the way, I am really glad that y'all are here to hear my story before you hear my husband's story tonight, because at least you'll hear the truth. He says we live in a 2-story house, his story and my story. I say we live in a 2-story house, his story and the truth. We have a friend, and he says like this. He says it's like, as Bill sees it, but Lois remembers. And so, anyway. So, anyway, you can see the pictures on his phone. He'll be glad to show you, but this is what I look like. I had buck teeth really, really bad, and my eye teeth were growing out through my gums because my baby teeth wouldn't fall out, so I looked like a vampire bunny. And I had a big nose. I went and got my nose fixed in my 20s, and my doctor at the time said, your nose would look better on a man, and I said, it does. It's my daddy's nose. It was real helpful, though, to hold up my glasses that I had to wear that were this big around and this thick because I can't see 3 feet in front of my face. I was a tomboy, had long, stringy hair, real skinny, and I was usually in hand-me-down clothes or garage sale clothes, usually T-shirts and jeans or cutoffs and tennis shoes or cowboy boots or barefoot. And that's kind of not real hygienic, you know. So they had a lot to work with, is what I'm telling you. So they made fun of me, and they did what kids do. They called me names. They tripped me going down the hall. And they threw things at me on my way home from school. They did stuff like that. And you know, that just taught me this, that if you're going to hurt me, you're not going to get close to me. And I just kept people at a different distance. I didn't have friends growing up. I really didn't. I was a latchkey kid. My mama worked during the daytime, and I came home and let myself in and took care of myself till my mama got home. And what happened was when my parents divorced, my mom didn't handle that real well. She was not thrilled about the divorce, and she started going out. And it was no big deal on the weekends. She would go out every Saturday night, every other Saturday night. And then she'd start going out every other Friday and Saturday night. And then she would start going out every Friday night and Saturday night. And it just became more and more and more. And my mom is not an alcoholic. She's not. She really is not. And she wasn't going out to get drunk. She was going out to find him. I know that today. But she was going out to get that spot filled. She needed him. And she was doing that. And what happened was, because she was in that process, she became obsessed with that. And she was gone all the time. And I got left at home a lot. And she would leave on a Friday to go to work, and I may not see her again or hear from her again until Monday morning, when she'd call me and tell me to get up and get ready and go to school. And I had become the parent in my household. I had become the mom. I was taking care of myself. I was washing the clothes. I was taking care of the house. It had just become my role, and I didn't think anything about that. That was normal for me. I just thought that that's what happened when parents got divorced. People would say to me when I got older and found out about that, why didn't you say anything to anybody? I didn't know there was anything wrong with that. That's just the way it was, and it was not a big deal. And at my daddy's house, it was a little different. I love my daddy. I am a daddy's girl. And my daddy started dating this woman I hated. And she didn't do anything to me. I just hated her. And when I go to my daddy's house, we'd always go over to her house. And he had met somebody just like him, hard-working woman. And they were always doing something at the house. They were working on the tractor or working out in the garden or fixing the fence or building a room addition or whatever. And I was just kind of around my daddy. I didn't really engage with my dad a lot, but I was just around him. And even that was enough for me, because I just loved my daddy. And I had rules over there, and I followed those rules. But at my house at home, I did not. And I could do whatever I wanted to. And I mean, I was literally 10 years old, and I'd be out in some really bad parts of town. My mom moved us around a lot. We moved from Moore to several different places. And we lived in a really bad part of town one time, and I'd be out at 2 o'clock in the morning and walking around just doing whatever I wanted to do, because I knew I could. And God was watching out for me my whole life, and I never even really paid attention. That's the truth. So what happened when I was 13, my daddy married that woman, and my mom met my stepdad. And my stepdad wanted to be the parent in our house, which I thought was a little ridiculous. I thought I was doing a pretty good job, but he didn't think so. And we kind of had some struggles there, but I'm really grateful for that man today, because he taught me a lot and he did a lot of things for me. And he got me braces and contacts, and he took me to buy store-bought clothes for the first time I could remember in my life. And he did a lot of good things for me, and he really did teach me a lot. And I really did love that man, and I just want you to know that, because our relationship does not end well. But he did a lot of good things for me, and he set rules and boundaries on me that I needed at the time, that I didn't really appreciate, but I needed at the time and desperately needed. And he did a lot of good things for me. But what happened was, when I was 16 years old, I caught him watching me take showers through the skylight in the bathroom. And a little bit after that, I was asked to leave that house, and I went to go live with my daddy. And I need you to hear that I really don't have a bad thing to say about that man. I mean, he really did a lot of good things for me. But when I got in this program, my sponsor asked me, she said, "Do you think your stepdad was an alcoholic?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, did he drink?" And I go, "Oh yeah, he drank every day." And she goes, "Well, let's talk about that. And let's tell me about that." And I said, "Well, he drinks beer like I drink water. And every night he would have an Ezra Brooks and Coke, and 10 times two." She goes, "Why do you think he's not an alcoholic?" And I said, "Well, I've never seen him drunk." She goes, "How do you know you never saw him sober?" Never crossed my mind. Never thought of that. I don't know if he was an alcoholic or not. I believe that he was. There's a lot of, I'm going to just tell you, he had a lot of similarities with a lot of y'all. And I do believe that he was an alcoholic. But I know that that man loved me, and I just know that he suffered. And I really never think anything negative about him, except when I'm talking about this particular part of my story. That's the truth. Anyway, I went to go live with my dad. The problem with living with my dad and moving in with my dad at that time is that he was dying. We have a kidney disease that runs in our family, and he was on a dialysis machine 3 times a week. And he was dying, and I knew he was dying. And that woman that I hated had learned to go to classes in school so that we could have a dialysis machine in our home, so my daddy didn't have to travel to the city every day or 3 times a week. And she was really good to him, and she took care of him, and she would come home from work and feed him dinner, and she would put him on that dialysis machine, and she would do all the stuff that needed to be done around the house. And then she'd get up the next morning, or she'd take him and put him to bed the next morning. She'd get up and she'd make coffee and they'd go about their day again. And she did, and she would work all day long and come back. And three times a week she'd put him on that machine and she took care of him. And she showed me what it was like to love somebody. And she really knew what it meant for better or worse in sickness and in health. Till death do you part. She really did know what that meant. And she showed that to me. And she became really close to me. I love that woman. And she was a great example. But he was dying and I couldn't, you know, once again, I think I'm in control and I think I'm in charge. And I think if I don't get close to him, he's not going to hurt me when he dies. It's not going to hurt as bad. Now I know that's ridiculous now, but at the time that made perfect sense. So I stayed really busy. I stayed really busy with school events. I stayed really busy at work. I did whatever I had to do. It was my senior year. It was in high school. And I just was not going to get close to him. It just was not going to happen. But God had other plans, and the week of my high school graduation, he got a kidney transplant from his twin sister and saved his life. And our relationship changed instantly. Instantly. I allowed my daddy to be a part of my life, and he allowed me to be a part of his, and we got really close. And we started talking, and we had got great conversations. My dad and I have spent hours and hours talking, and he likes to fish a lot, and we had a house out at the lake, and we'd go fishing a lot, and we'd go do stuff and ride trot lines and do all that kind of stuff. And I had a great relationship with my daddy. And then I met a man. I was 19. I met him in September. In November, he asked me to marry him, and we got married in March. It was not a popular decision at my house. I don't know what y'all were like at 19. I knew everything. My daddy tried to tell me this was a big mistake. I really thought that I knew what I was doing. I would love to tell you that he was the love of my life, and I knew that if I married him that we were going to live happily ever after. I would love to tell you the reason why I married him is because I knew that this is what I wanted. I married him because he asked. That's the truth. I was 19 years old. I was still that insecure little girl. I was scared to death, and I really thought that if I don't say yes to him, I will never have the opportunity to do this again. And so we got married. I instantly knew it was the biggest mistake of my life. But if you're somebody like me, I am never wrong, and I do not apologize. And and I absolutely hate being told I told you so. So we're not going to let anybody know it's the biggest mistake of our lives. We're just going to push on through, and we're going to make it work. And that's what I tried to do, and I was miserable. We had a little boy. He became the only reason I came home at night. I was miserable, and I was wanting a way out of my marriage. Now, what I really wanted is I wanted a way out of my marriage, and I wanted it to be all his fault. But he, I don't know why, but I have this idea of what that's going to look like, and there's some reasons to get divorced, and he did not meet any of these reasons that were in my head. I don't know where I got this, but this is the list. He didn't beat me. He didn't cheat on me. He wasn't an alcoholic. If he was, we might still be married. none of those things. Now, you know, he was verbally abusive to me. I couldn't trust him. There was a lot of other things going on. But for some reason, those aren't good enough in my mind to get a divorce. I don't know why, but it is not. And so I'm trying to figure out how to get out of my marriage. And I mean, it's been a struggle. And we've been married 7 years by this point. And I was working at a bank in the city. And one day, my way out of my marriage walked through the door. He was the best looking thing I'd ever seen. He's about 5'6". I like him short. I don't know why. I do. If you're short, I'm going to like you. If you're short and alcoholic, I'm going to love you. And I have discovered. Anyway, he's 5'6". He had this dark brown hair, these baby blue eyes, this great smile. He was always dressed, I mean, to the nines. And he'd walk in the bank. He was on my loan committee approval committee. He was on the board of directors, one of the owners of the bank, and he was the attorney for the bank. He'd walk in the bank, and all the girls would giggle and smile and bat their eyes, and all the guys would shake his hand and pat him on the back, and I would kind of hide from him because I could not form a sentence around him, which has never happened before or since. And one day he asked me to bring a file down to his office for lunch, and he took me to lunch, and that was it. I started dating him, and I left my husband. And you need to hear that because that's the order it happened in. I started dating him, and then I left my husband. I do not recommend that. That is not a good idea, but that is the truth. And I've lied about that to a lot of people, so you just need to know that that's really what happened. I started dating him, and then I left my husband. Do not do that. I'm just telling you, do not do that. I hurt a lot of people by being selfish and wanting my way. But that's what happened. I couldn't tell people that's what happened. I mean, when people would start asking about that or were you seeing him or stuff, I always come, I don't know how you guys are, but I can always make myself look good when I'm not. And I would say stuff like, oh no, we were separated long before I started dating him. We were separated. He was in the garage and I was in the kitchen. Or he would say, or they would say, were you guys dating? And I'd say, oh, no, no, no. My marriage was over long before I started dating him. Well, that was true. He just did not know it. So, but that's what I would say. I have to spin it. I have to make myself look better than I am because I am never wrong and I do not apologize. And that is a character defect that has followed me throughout my life. And, I've done some, step work on that and have sponsorship. I have now known that those are lies. That's what that was. So I was lying to everybody. And, people would find out that I was dating him, that knew him and knew me. And they would call me up and, they would say stuff like this. They'd say, I understand you're dating Cliff Gooding. And I'd say, yeah, do you know him? And they go, oh yeah. And I go, well, tell me about him. And this is generally the conversation that would happen. They'd say, well, he's really smart. He's brilliant. He's one of the most successful men you'll ever meet. And I knew that. He did his undergraduate in 3 years. He said the bar exam was the easiest exam he ever took. I had to sweat to get a C in algebra. But anyway, they said he's real successful. I knew that. He had this huge law firm when I met him. And they say, and he's a lot of fun. Well, I knew that. We had fun all the time. Every time I was around him, we had fun. And they'd say, but he's a liar. He's a cheat. He's arrogant. He's egotistical. You cannot trust him as far as you can throw him, and you need to stay away from him. Now, that's what they said. What I heard was, he needs you. My people are here. And and so, you know, I just thought that he needed me. And so we started dating and we were having a lot of fun. And I noticed that he doesn't sleep very much, like for days at a time. And then he sleeps for days at a time. And so I asked him about that. I go, why do you not sleep? And he said, well, I have a sleeping disorder. I've had it since college. I don't know how y'all are, but for me, that's a challenge flag. We're going to fix him. And so I said, well, you need to go see some doctors. And he said, oh, no, I have. And they, I've done all that, and they can't figure it out. Well, I'm just thinking, you haven't been to the right doctors. We're going to figure you out. So I proceed to try to fix him. And, I start asking him questions and I'm not getting any answers. I can't get any solutions to why he doesn't sleep and why he's out for days and why he can't be present. And so, I do what any sane person would do in that situation. I move in with him because you have to watch them 24/7 because I'm pretty sure he's drinking too much coffee. And he's not going to bed on time. There's something going on. I'm going to find out. And so I move in with him, and what happens is we start having problems. Shockingly enough, I know. I know you're surprised. And so we start fighting and arguing, and we'd not really had that yet. And we start arguing, and at first it was no big deal. It was just these little disagreements and stuff, and then they became fights. And I mean fights. When I divorced my husband, we had that little boy, and he got custody, and it was a big, big, huge thing. And but I had my son on weekends, and he had his daughter on weekends, and we had him in the summer. And when I tell you that we fought, I mean they were horrible fights. Those kids have seen more than any kids should see. They've heard their parents call each other names that nobody should ever say to anybody, much less their parents. And they've seen us fight and scream and holler and throw things and hit and slam doors and all that stuff. Those kids have seen some horrible, horrible things from their parents. I'm not proud of that, but that's exactly what happened. One night we got in a huge fight. I can't even tell you what it's about to this day. I cannot remember. He doesn't remember, but I can tell you he's not a violent man, but you put enough drugs and alcohol into somebody, you never know what's going to happen. And one time we were having a huge, gigantic fight. I can't tell you what it was about to this day. And for some reason he grabbed me by my hair and was pulling me down the hall, and I'm no victim here. I give just as good as I get, and I'm screaming and punching and hitting, and he's trying to slap me, and my little 8-year-old boy comes out of his room and he is scared to death and he is crying. And I just look at him and I said, go back in your room. Go back in your room. You see, that's my answer. Just go back in your room. That's the parent I am. Without you people, that's who I am. We're going to get up tomorrow. This is not going to be talked about. This doesn't happen. We're just going to act like this never happened. It's going to be no big deal. Just go back in your room. And that's what we did. Anyway, he and I are dating and fighting, and it's getting pretty bad. And one day he says, you know, maybe we should go see a counselor. And I thought, that is a great idea. I'd never been to a counselor, but I thought, that's a great idea. I don't know if y'all have ever been to a counselor, but I had not. And I don't know what it's like here, but when I went, they gave me this intake sheet. This lady gave me this intake sheet, and I had to fill it out. And it asked you questions on this intake sheet, like, have you ever drank more than two or three drinks at a time? Have you ever taken illegal drugs? Have you ever abused prescription drugs? Have you ever smoked marijuana? Have you ever had more than two sexual partners at a time? Have you ever dressed promiscuously? I am checking no as fast as I can check no and going, who comes in here? I mean, I just need some little relationship advice. What is this? I hand her that sheet. She says, give me about 10 minutes. I'm going to look at this. I'll come right back and we'll go over it. And I said, okay. And it looked like she had barely shut that door before she spun right back around. She looked at that sheet and she looks at me and she goes, well, looks like the only thing sick about you is that you're dating Cliff Gooding. Let's talk about that. That's what she said. What I heard was, see, it's him. It's not you. He's the one with the problem, not you. That's what I heard. We go to this counselor. We go to her for a couple of years. And you know, by this time, he has convinced her that he is bipolar. So she diagnoses him for that and gives him medication for that. And that made sense to me. That's why we have high highs. That's why we have low lows. That's why we can't sleep. That's why we can't sleep. That's why we can't eat. That's why we can't eat. And every time that we get leveled out and it starts going crazy again, he blames the medication. Oh, I didn't take it. I forgot to take it. I took too much. I didn't take enough. They've got it. I mean, whatever. And we go on this roller coaster ride for another few years. And he starts getting really jealous and crazy and starts, saying that I don't love him. And so I do what anybody would do in that situation. I marry him because we've got to prove to him how much we love him. And so we get married and nothing changes and it just gets worse and it just gets worse. And after we've been going to this counselor for a few years, she's had enough of us and she sends us to the psychiatrist, her psychologist. I don't know what she was, but she was great. And we've gone to her about three times and she had figured him out. What I found out later is about that time, I found out that she had been in Al-Anon for 8 years and when we went to her. And so she had given me a prescription for tranquilizers. She said, I want you to give him one at 6 o'clock. If he's not in bed by 10, give him another one, and then you just go to bed. And I said, okay, and that's what I did. I gave him one at 6, I gave him another one at 10, and I went to bed. I got up the next morning. He is not in bed with me, which at this time is not an uncommon occurrence. A lot of times he is usually passed out on the couch or on the other side of the room in our mother-in-law room. On this particular day, I woke up. He was not in bed with me. I went over. He was in the mother-in-law room. And I went to go open the door, and it was barricaded shut by a love seat. And the other door to the room was locked. Which, if you are an untreated Al-Anon of my type, that is no consequence for us. We can get in anywhere. We can break in on anybody, I promise you. We can find anybody. We can get in anywhere you need to be. I'm just telling you to this day, I promise you, if you would have told a group of Al-Anons that Osama bin Laden was a drunk and his family needed him, there would have been no need for military action. We could have found him in no time. Anyway, I break in on him. He's laying in bed, naked to the world. The ceiling fan's going 100 miles an hour. And next to the bed is an empty bottle of wine and an empty bottle of vodka. And up next to the bed, he has pulled up a TV. And on top of the adult videotapes that had ran out, there was a clear package with some white substance in it. And that's how I found out what was going on. People said to me later on, oh, you were in denial. I go, I wish I could blame denial. I was just an idiot. I had no clue. I thought he was cheating on me, but I didn't think he was drinking and drugging. But that's how I found out. I hit him as hard as I could hit him. He bolted up out of that bed. I shook that package at him, and I said, what the heck is this? That's not the exact words, but for these purposes, let's just go with it. I said, what the heck is this? He looked at me. He looked at that package. His eyes got real big, and he said, I don't know. I know this is going to surprise you, but another fight ensued. And we started fighting. He left. We were supposed to go pick up our daughter from camp that morning, and he left. And he came back a couple hours later. I said, what are you doing here? And he said, I live here. I said, not today, you don't. He said, well, what do you want me to do? And I said, why don't you go tell Wilma what's been going on? Now, Wilma is our daughter's mom. That's his ex-wife's mom, or his ex-wife. And I said, why don't you go tell Wilma what you've been doing? And he said, okay. And he left. And he came back a couple hours later. I go, what are you doing here? He goes, I live here. And I thought, oh, my God, he's still drunk. He does not remember. He has been in a blackout. And I said, not today. And he said, well, I did what you said. I went and told Wilma. She took me to a meeting. I'm going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I had no idea what he was talking about, nor did I care. And I said, that's great. You can't stay here. And so he left. And I called Wilma. Now, Wilma at this time had about 15 years in AA. I wish I could tell you that I called Wilma because I knew that and that I knew that she would have some solutions. I called her to check up on him because I didn't believe him. And I said, did he tell you what he's been doing? And she goes, yeah, I took him to a meeting. We're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I go, great. What do I do? She said, would you be willing to go to a meeting with me tomorrow? And I said, yeah. And the reason why I said yeah is because I had no ideas left to do. I tried everything. I tried everything to get him to act the way that I wanted him to act, and I had nothing left. Well, that's not true. I had one other idea. I was going to kill him. He was going to die. I am still convinced to this day that one of the worst things that can happen for untreated Al-Anons is for us to watch too many episodes of 48 Hours Mysteries and Forensic Files. We have planned your death four times, and you know. And we're pretty sure we can get away with it, and we might have some people to hide the bodies, is all I'm saying. So that was my only idea left. And so she asked me if I would go to a meeting with her the next morning, and I said yes. And so she took me to my first meeting, and she took me to my second meeting, and she took me to my third meeting. I don't know how you guys got here. I got here with the ex-wife. Works for us. So I started going to meetings, and about 45 days later, he relapsed. And he came in the door, and I go, you've been drinking. He goes, no, I haven't. I go, I think you have. He goes, no, I haven't. No, I haven't. I said, okay, well, let's just do a drug test. He goes, now, hold on. He got asked to leave the house again, and I called Wilma again. And she said, you know, maybe we should go to see an attorney, and let's have supervised visitation with our kids. And I thought that was a great idea. I wish I could tell you that I did that because I wanted to protect my kids and I knew that would be a safer option. I did that to punish him. I did that to punish him. I was going to make him pay. I'm a big punisher. I love to punish. I do. I was going to make him pay, and that's why I did it. I had no good motives when I got here. None. But we went to go see this attorney who happened to be in AA. And she says to me, hey, do you want a divorce? And I said, no. And she goes, well, what do you want? I said, you know, I just want him to be okay. She said, well, if that's true, here's what you need to do. You need to decide what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. And then you need to go talk to him, and you need to be very matter of fact. But when you have this conversation with him, you need to be really calm. Now, I'm just going to tell you, there are 1,000 adjectives that can describe me. Calm ain't making the list. I've never been calm in my life. I've never seen calm. I don't know what calm is. I don't know. I don't know what that means. But after 45 days in Al-Anon, the one thing that I knew was the Serenity Prayer. I had a really good job at the time, and I was driving in my car a lot. And so what I did is I just drove around all day long, and I said the Serenity Prayer. And I'm not kidding. If I said it once, I said it 500 times that day. That is not a lie. And I got home, and I called him, and I asked him to come home. I wanted to talk to him, and he came home, and I grabbed his hands, and I looked at him, and I said, listen, I know that this is hard, and I know you must be scared, and I know you have a problem, and I'm willing to do whatever I need to do. If I need to go to meetings or counseling or treatment or whatever it is that I need to do, I'm willing to do that. And I'll do whatever I need to do my part, but only if you can do your part. And if you can't do your part, I can't stay. Now, that may not sound like a big deal to you, but it was huge to me at the time. Because up until that time, I have never been okay without him. No matter who he is, I've never been okay without him. I've never been comfortable in my own skin. I've never been okay without having somebody else. And I knew that no matter what he said that day, no matter if he said, screw you, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, and if you don't like it, you can leave, I knew it was going to be okay. I really did. In the depths of my soul, I knew I was going to be okay. But that's not what he said. He said, you're right, I've got a problem. I don't have a sleeping disorder and I'm not bipolar, which I kind of had figured out, but I appreciated the verification. And I said, well, what are you going to do different? And he said, I'm going to ask a man to sponsor me tomorrow that's going to hold me accountable. And that's what he did. The next day he went and asked that man to be his sponsor, and he's been sober ever since. But that left me with me. And when the obsession in my life starts getting healthier and I do not have a solution, I get sicker. And I'm just going to meetings. And that's all I'm doing is I'm just going to meetings because that's all I know. And I am watching him like a hawk because he's going to relapse and I'm going to catch him. And then I'm going to punish him because that's what I do. And so that's what I'm going to do. And I'm watching him and I'm waiting and I'm asking him a million questions. And, you know, he can't breathe without me on him. And I'm going crazier and crazier and he's getting better. And finally somebody said, do you have a sponsor? And I thought, oh, that might be a good idea. And so there was a lady that I was going to meetings with, and she always had this great stuff to say. And I loved everything. I didn't know her from Adam, but I loved everything that she said. And one day I followed her out of the meeting and I asked her if she'd sponsor me. And she gave me her number and she said, yeah, call me tonight. And I did. I called her that night. And so the first thing she asked me, she said, why do you think you need Al-Anon? So I told her everything that he had ever done. He did this and he did that. And I just went on and on and on. And I don't know if I paused or took a breath or what, but she said, well, now we know he's not the problem, you are. Let's talk about that. She seemed so sweet in those meetings, too. But I'm going to tell you, when she said that to me, it hit me like a ton of bricks. It's exactly what I needed to hear. It penetrated everything. It made me, I was no longer in denial about what was going on here. You see, I was powerless over alcohol, and my life was unmanageable by me, not by him. He was getting better. I was getting crazier. Had nothing to do with him. Had everything to do with me. And that's when I took my first step and we started going through these steps. We identified the powerlessness and the unmanageability in my life. We started talking about step two and we talked about insanity, and I didn't know I was insane. I didn't know what that was until she told me it was the same thing, doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. Now let me tell you something, that hit home with me. I had tried everything to get somebody to act and do the way that I thought that they should act and do. I have tried pleading, begging, crying. I have threatened. I have punished. I have checked cars. I have checked wallets. I have looked through emails. I have listened to voicemails. I've tried everything to catch them and make sure that I found out what was going on so I could punish them. I said that one time in a meeting. A girl came up to me afterwards. She goes, how did you get his passcodes to his email and his phone? I go, you may not qualify for this program. That's kind of a rookie move. We can figure that out. Anyway, I tried everything. I've tried everything. If there was a way to get another person sober, I'd have figured it out. If there was another way to get somebody to do what I needed them to do, I'd have figured it out. I promise you. I may look stupid, but I am not. And I have tried everything. I have tried everything, and nothing worked. Nothing worked. But the crazy thing about that is, every time I tried something, every single time, I thought, this is the time he's going to hear it. This is the time it's going to work. This is the time that he's going to go, oh, I get it. You want me to act? Okay, okay. Every single time. And I did that over and over and over again. And always thought it was going to be different this time. Always. I told you that my daddy started that Trinity Bible Baptist Church. I grew up in church. I started going to church. After my parents' divorce, I was the only one in my family that continued to go to church. I know now that I was seeking. I didn't know that, but I didn't know that then, but I know that now. So we got to step three. We talked about a power greater than ourselves. I said, yeah, I believe in God. We got to step three. She said, do you trust God? And I said, yes. And she said, no, you don't. And I thought, how dare you? And I said, well, of course I do. She goes, of course you don't. And I said, oh, how dare you? You know, yes, I trust in God. And she goes, really? Really? You trust in a higher power? Trust in God? Yeah. Okay, when's the last time you gave something to God and you didn't try to manipulate, control, or fix it yourself? Couldn't think of anything. Had me stumped on that one. She said, you've been doing his job your whole life. You don't trust him at all. And she was right. The only thing that I could think of is my little boy, when he was 3 days old, had to have open heart surgery. Gave that to God. If I had been a surgeon, probably not. Gave that to God. That's the only time. When I had nothing left, that's the only time he got anything. So we had to practice having faith. We had to practice trust. She had me do my 4-step. I called her up. I said, I've done my 4-step. She said, great. Be at my house Saturday at 10 o'clock. We're going to do your 5th step. I said, okay. So I went, had planned on doing that. I was working at the time. It was fall break. It was on a Friday. We were remodeling our kids' rooms at the time. The only thing left to do in our daughter's room was to get her bedding. It was Friday afternoon. I get a call from my husband, and he says, hey, guess what we did today? And I said, what? He goes, we went and got Rachel's bedding. I was instantly incensed. How dare you do that without me? How dare you do that without my approval? I didn't say that because I had a sponsor. I just hung up the phone, and I got home that night, and I said, well, let's see what you got. And they showed me. And I said, you know what? I said, this color does not match her room. And I said, and this material set in, she's going to tear it up in no time. And I said, and you spent way too much money on this. He's trying to do a decent thing, and I just tore into shreds. And he said, okay. So the next morning, I took that stuff, and I threw it in the trunk of my car, and I went to go do my 5th step. This does not end well. So we started on my 5th step. We hadn't gotten very far, and she said, hey, I need to go get something to drink. You want anything? I said, no. She said, okay. She came back, and she said, hey, before we get started any farther, is there anything that maybe has happened that's not on this 5th step that we need to talk about? And I thought, oh, my God, he called her. And I said, yes. And she said, what is it? And I told her about the bedding. She said, well, do you know what you did when you said all that? And I said, yes. Once again, I had to have my way, and I had to be right. And I had to be in charge and control. She goes, oh, no, that's not what you did. You see, when you told her that that material, that color didn't match her room, you told her her opinion did not matter. And when you told her that that material was too thin and she'd tear it up in no time, you told her that whatever decision she made for the rest of her life, you would always know best. And when you told her it was too expensive, you told her she wasn't worth it. You see, those are the exact nature of my wrongs. It's not the big stuff that I can see. It's those things like that that I don't even pay attention to. Those little things that do all the damage that I've done to everybody in my whole life. Every single day. And never given it a thought. Not a thought. I've done that to everybody my whole life. We went back through. We started over with my 5th step. We went back through. We identified the exact nature of my wrongs. In every relationship, in every instance, and in everything that I did that caused damage. The exact nature of my wrongs. The times that I, because of my audacity to think that I knew better, that I somehow knew what was best for you, and that I was always right, that I had hurt everybody around me. Nobody around me could make a good decision because of me. I made sure that they knew that. We got done with my 5th step. I got home. She had me go home to do 6 and 7. I made a list of my character defects. And then I went home and I apologized to that little girl. And I told her what I had done and how I was wrong. And she cried and I cried. And then she said, that's not what I wanted anyway. That we took her to go get stuff, and we let her pick it out, and I didn't say a word. I let her have whatever she wanted. I made a list of my character defects. I called my sponsor. We went over them. I was entirely ready. I will just tell you, I was entirely ready. When I got down with that 5th step, I was both humiliated and horrified and both and relieved at the same time, because I did not want to be that person anymore. And I knew that there was a solution, and I knew that I didn't have to be that person anymore. I didn't want to do that damage anymore. I didn't want to hurt the people in my life that I loved the most the way that I'd been hurting them. And I wanted to be something different. I knew I did not want to continue to be the way I had been. And she said, you don't have to change anything. You have to change everything. But you don't have to do it today all at once. It took you a long time to get here. It's going to take you a little bit to get out of it. And so she set me on my steps and the rest of my steps. And I made my list of character defects. We went over that as we were entirely ready. I did my 8-step list and I started making my amends. I told you that my husband had gotten my custody of our son. I thought was one of the worst things that could ever happen to me when that happened. He told me he was going to make me pay, and he did. And we had gone to court several times, and we had fought, and we were always constantly battling. And what I realized is that God was taking care of that little boy this whole time. You know, he wasn't a great husband, but he was a great dad. And my son grew up in a good town and with good schools and good people, and he was safe. And if he'd have been in our house, he'd have probably got taken away anyway, because he saw enough on the weekends. I can't imagine what it would have been like if he'd been there full time. That's the truth. And so one day I'm picking up or dropping off, I can't tell you what, and I said, can I talk to you? And he said, sure. And we got out of the car, and I'm sure he's thinking, oh God, what now? And I said, listen, I just want to tell you how much I appreciate you being Colby's dad. And I want you to know what a great job you've done. And I'm glad that he's been with you, and you've done a great job as his dad. He turned white. I thought he was going to pass out in that parking lot. He didn't say anything but okay. And then I got in my car and left. And I got about 5 minutes down the road, and he called me. He said, I can't tell you what that means to me. He said, you see, I never thought that I did a very good job. I really didn't think that you thought that. And I appreciate that. Somehow after that, he got better. And you know, I fought and fought for that little boy, and after that, I just left it alone. I gave it up, and we had a good relationship, and everything was fine, and then he turned 18 and moved in with me, so be careful what you ask for is all I'm saying. I wasn't even home when he moved in with us. I'm not kidding. I was in New York. Cliff was home, and I got a call, and Kobe says, I'm moving home, and I go, now? And he's like, yeah. I go, okay. I called Cliff. I go, Kobe's moving home, and he goes, here? And I was like, yeah. Anyway, when my stepdad kicked me out of that house, my mom didn't say a word, and I didn't talk to my mama for 3 years, and I barely had talked to her since. And my sponsor had me start emailing her every week, because my mom liked to email, and so I'd start emailing her every week, and then she made me start calling her every week. And I called her on Wednesday nights, and I can't even tell you how long it was, but one day at night, I'm having a conversation with my mom on a Wednesday night, and she says to me, I can't tell you how many times I've cried myself to sleep for the way that I raised you and the things that I allowed to happen and the way I treated you. And out of my mouth came, well, Mom, you need to learn to forgive yourself, because I've forgiven you a long time ago. And it was the truth. And I can't even tell you when that happened or how that happened. But I had. And I did the rest of my amends. I made amends to my brother and my sisters and the rest of my amends. And a month before I got in this program, my daddy died. And I had dinner at my daddy's house and my stepmom every Wednesday night. And after my daddy died, my stepmom said, hey, are you still going to come out for dinner on Wednesday night? And I said, of course I am. And she's like, okay, good. I was a little afraid that you might stop. And I'm thinking, it's a free home-cooked meal. Now I'm, you know. But I said, of course I am. And she said, okay. And, you know, I started, and my sponsor had me finish up the steps, and we did the 10th step, which is, you know, she has me do the 10th step every day, which is just to keep my side of the street clean, make sure that I can look myself in the mirror, and I'm not afraid to find anybody on the street today. I've cleaned all that up, and I try to keep that clean. I still hate apologizing. I really do. Ask my husband the first time that I had to call him and apologize. I had to leave it on his voicemail because he was in court. He kept that thing until his phone died. He'd just replay it every once in a while. It's just such a rare occurrence. And so, and I love the 11th step prayer, which is thought through prayer and meditation. And I'm going to tell you, prayer and meditation is something I do every single day. I do the 3rd and 7th step prayer on my knees every single morning. I know it is out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They let us use their steps and their traditions. I'm pretty sure it's okay. We borrow their prayers. Please do not say anything to me. Anyway, soapbox, sorry. I love prayer and meditation. And, my sponsor said, think of it, prayer is talking to God and meditation is Him talking to you. And I kind of keep it that simple. I love the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, that's a promise. If you do these steps, you'll have a spiritual awakening. I can't tell you when that's going to happen or how it's going to happen. I can just tell you it's going to happen. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others in our program. We tried to take it to alcoholics. Y'all don't listen. And we practice these principles in all of our affairs, which is absolutely critical and key for me today. Critical and key for me today. If I cannot pay my electric bill, but I can buy a brand new pair of shoes, I am not practicing these principles in all my affairs. If I go to the doctor and he says, hey, listen, your blood pressure's a little high, you need to, ratchet it back on the food, and every time I sit down, I eat like I am going to the electric chair, I am not practicing these principles in all my affairs. If I'm really sweet and kind to everybody here, but I talk down or talk bad to my coworkers or to my husband or my kids, I am not practicing these principles in all my affairs. It says in all my affairs, not in just the ones that has to do with alcoholism or in these rooms, in all my affairs. And that is critical and key for me today. I do not get to pick and choose. I have to practice in all my affairs. That's everything. That's everything. After my dad died, about 5 years later, my stepmom started dating this man, and she wanted me to meet him, and his name is Herschel. My stepmom is a tall woman. She's about 5'11". She's got white hair. She kind of looks like, she looks a lot like the women's Tennessee old basketball coach, Pat Summitt. Think Pat Summitt, my stepmom. And so she started dating this guy, and she said, hey, listen, I really want you to meet Herschel. And I said, okay. And she said, but I need to tell you something. And I said, what? He goes, he's only about 5'6". I go, Mom, you may not notice, but I'm okay with that. And Herschel is 5'6", beautiful blue eyes, gorgeous, cute little man, sweet as he can be. So I met him, and a couple months later, I took my mom to New York on vacation, and we were walking around the streets of New York. We were having a great time, and all of a sudden, I said, I didn't think you'd get married again, but I could see you marrying Herschel. She said, I could, too. We got back, and a couple months later, she called me. She said, hey, I need to talk to you about something. I said, you're getting married, aren't you? She said, well, not if you're not ready. I know how much your daddy meant to you, and if this is too much or this is too soon, I can wait. I know, isn't that sweet? I said, Mama, don't you ever give me that much power again. I said, my daddy would have loved Herschel, and he would not want you to be alone, and he would not want you to be lonely. And they got married, and Herschel's a sweet man. I love him. And in September or October of 2010, I got a phone call. 2011, I got a phone call, my stepmom was in the hospital. And I went to go see her, and she was having trouble breathing, and she had never been sick a day in her life, so that was really odd. And she was really having trouble breathing, and she was in there for like 10 days, and she had organized pneumonia in her lungs. And she was there for a little bit, and then she'd leave. And then she went back, and I think in like October, the 1st of November, and then she was home for Thanksgiving, and then she was back in, and then she was home at Christmas, and then at the first of the year, she went back again, and they just couldn't figure it out. And went to see her. It was on a Monday, and I went to see her, and we had a great time. We talked, and she was doing good. She had a little nasal cannula out. She didn't even have the big oxygen or anything, and I was talking to her, and all of a sudden, it was getting close to 5 o'clock, and she said, hey, she said, don't you have a meeting to go to? And I said, you know what? I could skip it tonight. She goes, no, you just go ahead and go. She had been to hear me speak. She had heard Cliff. She knew what AA and Al-Anon had done for us. She had seen the changes in our life, and she loved you people. And I said, "Are you sure?" And she said, "Yeah." And so I went to go meet with my home group. And when I left, she says to me what she says to me every single time I leave her. She said, "Remember, I love you." And I said, "Okay, I will. I love you too." And she says, "Don't forget." And I won't. And we say that every time we leave each other. We'd been going through some, Cliff and I had been going through some stuff, and I had asked him to leave the house again. He had not drank. He had not cheated on me. He had not used. He had not done any of those things. And you guys may not have heard about it, but he had become the sheriff of AA. And he was regulating everybody. And he had become the person I did not know. And most people wouldn't kick their husband out for something like that, but I'm just going to tell you, I live in a sober home today, and that means sober in every single area and aspect of our life. And he became somebody I did not recognize, and I had asked him to leave the house. And he had been out of the house for a few months at this time, and he had been working on himself, and he was staying with another man in AA, and he had been doing good. This week I called him. It was on a Friday, and I said, "Hey, I think I'm ready for you to come home." And he said, "Can I come tonight?" And I said, "Yes." And so he came home. It was on a Friday night. And that next morning we got up and we were going to a basketball game at OSU. And we came back, and I got up that morning and ran with some of my friends. We'd ran 6 miles. We're getting ready for this thing. I don't do that anymore, by the way. Sanity has returned. And I was really tired, and I said, "I'm just going to lay down here for about 10, 15 minutes, and then we were going to go to dinner and a meeting with some friends." And I laid down, and the phone rang, and it was Herschel. And I answered the phone, and he said, "Your mama's gone." And I was not expecting that. And he said, "Would you come down to the hospital and tell her goodbye?" And before I got to the hospital, there was a member of AA and Al-Anon waiting on us at the doors. And they walked me upstairs to say goodbye to my mama. The next day I was at their house, and it was just Herschel and I. And my stepmom had insisted on sleeping in her bed at the top of the stairs. The problem was that by the time that she got to the top of the stairs, she literally would collapse and fall across her bed, and she could not even get undressed. And so Herschel had bought her a chairlift, and it had gotten installed the day before she went to the hospital. And I can't tell you why I asked this question. I don't even know why I said this. I usually do not care. I don't know what we were doing. It was just he and I. And I said to him, "Herschel, how much did you pay for that chairlift?" And he said, "I don't know, $2,700. And I said, "And she got to use it one time." And without missing a beat, he looked me straight in the eye, and he said, "It was worth it." And that taught me this. No matter what's happened to me in my life, no matter what pain I have caused others or what other pain has been done to me, no matter what has happened in my life, if it got me to you, it was worth it. I would not change absolutely anything if it was going to cost me missing the chance to be here with you today. That's the truth. Everything in my life today is because of AA and Al-Anon. Absolutely everything. It gave me a God of my understanding that I never had before I got here. I couldn't get it in church. That's not the church's fault. I just couldn't hear it then. I wasn't ready. It was a horrible year that year. Mom died in January. In February, we had a horrible family tragedy that involved a murder and a suicide. In March, we had to move our law offices 6 floors, and we had like 2 weeks' notice to do it. In April, my son had a car wreck, and he was perfectly fine, but he totaled his truck, and I had gotten this insurance check, and he wanted me to give him the insurance check, and I said, "No, you can go buy a vehicle for this much money, but I'm not giving you the check." And he got mad and left, and he had been moved out by this time, and he did not talk to me. He would not return a phone call. He would not return a text message, and I was blowing up his phone, and I was texting him and calling him, and I mean, like I'd never been in a meeting of Al-Anon. "By God, I paid this phone. I'll turn it off. You don't call me back." I mean, real spiritual, mature stuff like that. And finally, I called my sponsor, and she said, "Okay, he's not talking to you." And I said, "No." She goes, "Okay, here's what we're going to do." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Leave him alone." which I thought was a little ridiculous, but I have always been willing to listen to what she says and do what she says. I don't know why, but I have always been willing to do what she says. And I said, okay. And so I did. I left him alone. It had been 3 months, and I had not talked or heard from him. And she says to me, have you heard from Colby? And I was like, no, I've left him alone. And she said, okay, here's what you can do. You can get him a card. And the only thing it can say is, I love you and I miss you, Mom. That's it. Nothing else. I said, okay. She said, I mean it. It does not get to say, it would be really great to see you. I miss your voice. Does not get to say that. I love you and I miss you, Mom. That's it. I go, okay. I got the card. At that time, I have a sponsee, and at that time, her best friend's husband worked with my son. Monday night at my home group, I give her the card. I said, could you get this card to Colby? She said, sure. The next morning at 10 o'clock, Colby starts calling me. Hey, Mom, I'm really sorry. I was mad, and I love you, and I miss you, and I miss Cliff. Do you think we could get together for dinner sometime? I'd really like to talk to you. I was so excited. So I called my sponsee. I said, so you got Colby that card? She goes, no, still in my car. You see, God always shows up, but sometimes he shows out. I'm just supposed to follow direction and get out of the way. And he always takes care of the rest. And why sometimes I fail to remember that is beyond me. There is still some insanity, obviously, here in my mind at any time. Because there are still days where I still think that I've got a good idea or that I know better. To this day. My son last year joined the Army. I don't mean he went to the recruiter's office and joined the Army and did not tell me. I meant he was in boot camp and I did not know. And I called his dad. I found out through a Facebook post. I called his dad. I said, did Colby join the Army? And he said, yes. And I said, he didn't tell me. And he goes, I know. And I told him to tell you. And I can't, you know, he said he was going to. And I told him to tell you. And I was like, I cannot believe he did not tell me. And for 2 days, I walked around going, I cannot believe he did not tell me he joined the Army. How dare he not tell me he joined the Army? I am his mother. Why would he not tell me he joined the Army? And all of a sudden, it was like God hit me over the head and went, duh. He did not tell you. Why would he tell you? Every time he's made any decision in his life, you have always known better. Every time that he's done anything that he did not approve of, you let him know. Of course he did not tell you. Now, I had made amends to my son. I really had. But obviously, God saw fit that I needed to make a deeper amends. I got a letter from him a few days later that said, hey, Mom, I've joined the Army. And it said stuff like this. It said, I hope you're not too upset with me because of this decision, but it's something that I had to do for me. And I understand if you don't, if you hate me, because sometimes I hate myself. And it said stuff like, I just didn't want our last conversation to be a fight. And it said stuff like, I know you must, I hope you're not disappointed in me, but if you are, I understand, because sometimes I'm disappointed in myself. It was the saddest and sweetest letter I've ever read. And I cried and cried, and I got to write him back, and I got to tell him how much I loved him and how I took full responsibility for being the reason why he could not tell his mother that he had joined the Army, because I had not been safe for him. And I had told him that that was all on me and that I didn't blame him at all, and that I loved him and I was proud of him. And he didn't get to stay in the Army because he had that open heart surgery, and he didn't get to finish out. But I don't know why that happened, and maybe it's just because I needed to make a deeper amends to him. But he and I are good today. And 3 weeks ago, he had a motorcycle crash, and it was really bad. And they called me. And I've spent every single day with him almost since then. And you people here in Georgia have heard about him, and y'all prayed for him. And I had hundreds, and if not thousands, of people all over the world praying for that little boy. He is 26 years old. And I got to leave him this weekend, and he is doing absolutely fine. And that is a miracle. And that's because I know. Because of the prayers of you people. That little girl, That little girl has been drinking and drugging since she was 16 years old. And about 3 years ago, she called her daddy and said, I need help. I can't stop drinking and I can't stop taking pills. And he did what you guys taught him to do and gave him a number of a lady in AA. And she got sober. She went to detox. She got sober. She celebrated 1 year. And the day after her 1 year anniversary, she had the most beautiful baby girl you've ever seen in your whole entire life. And then she decided she didn't need you people anymore. And she's back out there and she's going and running again. And I'm just going to ask you to pray for her. Because it's about all I can do is pray for her. And I can't help her, but hopefully you guys can. And I haven't given up on her. But I know there's nothing else I can do for her. And I love her, but she has been taken over by this disease. There was a couple back home, Jack and Hody Mitchell. And they were a great AA couple, and Hody also went to Al-Anon, and they were a great influence in my early recovery. And Hody learned a prayer from an American Indian Reservation in Arizona, and she brought it back to us, and there are a few of us that know it. And so when we're asked to close with the Lord's Prayer, we say this, and this is the prayer. I've been told that the reason we join hands is to remind us of the truth that we are no longer alone. Our prayers for the still suffering alcoholics in these rooms and on the streets. Hold on to the person's hand next to you like your life depends on it, because someday it may. Thank you for holding my hand and allowing me to hold yours.